appointment and your efforts on behalf. Next case for argument is Cuevas versus the United States. Mr. Ackerman.
Please, the court. Counsel for the government, I'm Alan Ackerman. I represent the petitioner, Mr. Joseph Cuevas. Mr. Cuevas takes the position, as the petitioner appellant, that the district court abused its discretion in not granting him a hearing, period. The facts are not in dispute. After he was convicted in the United States District Court in Urbana, his family hired a private investigative firm, Pinnacle and Associates, Michael Anthony. The family, not the defendant. The essence of it was, based on Judge Williams' dissenting opinion on direct appeal, the investigators were supposed to try and run down additional information that could assist Mr. Cuevas in getting a new trial. For reasons that are utterly unexplained in the record, Pinnacle Research went to the U.S. District Court where the case was tried, gathered from the clerk's office, I'll assume, the names and addresses of at least some of the jurors, and went and attempted to interview them. The interviews yielded information regarding pervasive premature jury deliberations vis-a-vis Cuevas' guilty from the first day of trial.
But Mr. Ackerman, putting briefly to one side the question how district courts are supposed to enforce rules like 47.2, which require the court's permission before these kinds of interviews take place, or the 606B rule once the information is collected somehow, I don't see in your argument anything but this vague reference to the heroin, which I don't think comes up until your reply brief, that external influences were brought to bear on this jury. It's solely a premature deliberation point where the jurors are sitting over lunch or whatever they're doing before they're supposed to, before they've been instructed by the court, before they've heard all the evidence, but they're talking about the case. Is that correct?
Yes and no.
Well, all right.
Doe number one claimed to have had a conversation with the district court judge before that juror was excused for back problems. That juror told the investigators that she/he told the judge that everybody said the defendants were guilty and that juror wanted no part of it. When the district court reported that the juror left or was being excused, health was the only reason. As to Doe number five, that's the juror who spoke of heroin and spoke in terms of how it shattered her her family for 15 years. And further, that juror would not be surprised if Cuevas' store in Indiana was a front for dope.
Could I ask you about the first one for a minute?
Yes.
I don't quite see whether you're arguing that something like what the Third Circuit required in Resco should have taken place. Once the judge hears from the juror that information that implies that they've been talking about the case, that the judge should have done something. What is exactly your position on that?
My position is this. First of all, I'm very hesitant to ever think that a United States District Court judge would not have an inquiry were that statement made to the judge. I truly am hesitant. I've practiced in this building and other district courts for almost 40 years. It's my experience that if a juror says something like that to a district court judge during a trial or even after trial, the district court judge spreads it of record. Now, what happened here, I do not know. But what I do know is that the government did not challenge the statement from the investigator that's part of the petition indicating that the juror did tell the judge just that. Now, what should the judge have done? Absolutely stopped the trial, gone out on the bench, told the lawyers what had he heard, and commenced an inquiry of the jury. Absolutely. Because it may well have been that A, the jurors would have said, well, yes, we did. But B, no, it won't make any difference in our ultimate conclusion. We were just chit-chatting. And we're sorry, but we'll follow your instructions.
But doesn't that take you back to the local rule? Because if somebody had gone to the district court and said, we'd like to interview the jurors, perhaps the judge might have had some view of the reputation of the firm or the individual who wanted to do the interviewing, or perhaps there might have been some sort of rules of the road for that. I mean, I think Judge Gilbert was concerned about how does one enforce such rules if you don't, in some fashion or another, punish for their violation. And he used an exclusionary kind of remedy.
It's a very harsh remedy when you're talking about a defendant who was serving 121 months in jail under circumstances where that may have been a tainted jury. And that's the difference. We're talking about the niceties of Rule 47.2 in a civil case. Okay, the damages were $82,000, and somebody went and spoke to the jurors and now files a post-trial motion.
But we don't have an external influence case, aside from the personal experiences that you're talking
about. And I cite authority for the proposition that is, in fact, extrinsic or external. Now, whether the government...
But then the whole rule unravels. Then you have every conviction is going to be followed by an investigation of the jurors. It's going to be very hard to find jurors.
I think this is a very rare case, Judge Posner. Seriously, I do. Because...
Oh, I don't think so. Before we had this rule in Wisconsin on juror contact after verdict, lawyers were always going out talking, trying to find something.
Well, what I meant by rare or unique is that the investigative firm was exonerated on the rule to show cause because they didn't do it purposefully or willfully. And besides, in tab 3 of our separate appendix, or tab 3 of the brief, the judge discounted whatever was learned. I'll take my last moment for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Ackerman. Mr. Cox?
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Richard Cox. I'm an Assistant United States Attorney in the Central District of Illinois. I think the one thing that has throughout that Mr. Ackerman on behalf of Mr. Cuevas has ignored is that there are rules and procedures that must be followed. He wants to jump to the end, and I agree that if those facts were proven in a proper procedure and following the rules, perhaps we might have a different issue. But we can't forget where we are in this case, and that is that we are on collateral review. The denial of collateral review, now an appeal from the denial of that collateral review, and on interviews that allegedly, by the information supplied by the petitioner, didn't occur for at the very most after 2 years of the trial, and some of them not even for 2.5 years after the trial.
How long has the Southern District had this rule?
This is the Central District's rule, Your Honor. Yes. The matter was transferred to Judge Gilbert from Judge McCuskey in the Central District. I'm not sure precisely when it came in, Your Honor, but a version of it has been in effect since I began in the Central District of Illinois in 1982. I won't say it's precisely the same version as it is now, because it has been amended several times, but there have been rules governing post-verdict contacts with jurors for at least 20 years in the Central District of Illinois. I would also like to point out that there are many other ways that the interests that Mr. Ackerman on behalf of Mr. Cuevas seeks to articulate before this court are preserved during the whole trial process. We rely on jurors to report problems with fellow jurors. That happens all the time. We see cases about that. There are the observations of the parties, the judge, the attorneys for the parties in the courtroom. There are observations from court personnel. There are observations from spectators. All of these are available during the process. None of that was brought to the attention of the district court. And then after the jurors reach a verdict, then we have prohibitions, and actually this rule is not a prohibition, it's a rule of procedure rather than prohibition. The defendants at that time, petitioner now, didn't seek to follow the rule. A lot of times this information comes to the court by virtue of an unexpected contact. A juror, someone on behalf of a juror, someone on behalf of a defendant contacts defense attorney, contacts government attorney, sends letters to the trial judge. None of that happened here. This only happened because the investigative firm, more than 2 years after the verdict, went out and interviewed jurors in violation of the local rule. So I think, first off, it was clearly not an abuse of discretion for Judge Gilbert to affirm or to refuse to consider the evidence because of the violation of the rule, and even more so because it clearly was not proper evidence under the rules of evidence. So for those reasons, Your Honor, we would ask you to affirm the decision of the district court. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Cox. Mr. Ackerman, how much time did you have? 3 minutes?
45 seconds. The government filed a 28-J letter citing to U.S. versus Venske, V-E-N-S-K-E. It's now cited at 296 Federal 3rd, 1284. But particularly, I'd ask the court to consider page 1289 and footnote 4, because in that particular case, the defendants, who had nothing to do with the hiring of the investigator who went and involved himself with post-jury interviews, the district court offered them an evidentiary hearing on jury misconduct, notwithstanding the fact that the interview took place without the guidance of the district court, in fact, in violation of the district court. Similarly, I filed a 28-J, U.S. versus Schwartz, 283 Federal 3rd at 97, where again the same thing happened without benefit of court. Counsel spoke to jurors, filed post-trial affidavits. The district court wouldn't consider it. Court of Appeals found otherwise. 283 Federal 3rd at 98. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you to both counsel. Last case for argument is Van Grohl.